Well, we're doing something a little bit different tonight. The information is taken out of Thrice Greatest Hermes, Volume 1. There are three volumes to it. It's if you're interested in classical mythology as it relates to the spiritual mysteries, excellent source. Translations that are made by people that are involved with spiritual quests, and the information that it covers in the classical times concerning the subject of Hermes and the Hermetic mysteries are most excellent. So we're going to tell one story, and we'll tell it as many times as we can tonight. And each time we'll try to say a little bit more relative to it. What we're going to talk about is we're not going to take the standard myth, the whole myth. It's about Ahtar-Heru-Ur, which we know as Isis, Osiris, and Horus. And it's not certainly not the total myth about any one of the three, because there are volumes and volumes and volumes about Greek mythology, about Egyptian mythology, and it's very, very complex, and it's very nasty to deal with, because the Egyptians did something different than the... Remember when we were talking about the Hindus? The Hindus had original source material in the Rig Veda, and then succeeding generations wrote commentaries, and those commentaries became called the Upanishads. So you had the original, and then you had a set of commentaries. Later on, you had another set of commentaries or another set of books called the... I'm not focused on what I'm talking about at this moment. The Puranas. And then there are other mythical works. What the Egyptians did, supposedly they had the same mythology at all different periods of time. But it was tied up with their religion and their medicine, and it was very political. And they wanted to have a standard doctrine so that they could have a standard belief throughout the country, which they tried to keep unified. Egypt was probably the most well-educated in the country in the ancient world and the most unified in the ancient world. And so what they would do is from time to time, they would give new versions of the old myths that were up to date, but they would kill all of the old stuff or as much of it as they could. And they are called recensions. So you might have the same, you might have the Book of the Dead. You might have several different recensions of the Book of the Dead, and you don't know what really went on in between there. You don't have a continuous body of knowledge. So there is a lot of information about Isis, Osiris, and Horus, but we're taking ours from a Greek source. And it's a Greek source that was an initiate into the mysteries of Isis and Osiris, as well as an initiate in the Eleusinian mysteries, and also was very much involved with the priestcraft at Delphi, the Apollo priestcraft at Delphi. His name is Plutarch, if you're familiar with Plutarch. So rather than get too involved with scholarship, we'll tell the story once just to get the feel of the story. The early protagonists in the story are up here in the Grand Gallery. This is not what the story is about. This is just happens to have everybody in it. This happens to be the eldest of their... Remember we started talking about the Titans. This is Ra and Heru. And they are Temu. I'm sorry. And they are mated together. And then there is Shu and Tefnut and Seb and Nut. These sort of form like the Titans in that ancient group. And Ra, who is the same as Helios in the Greek mythology, was sort of the central head of everything. But at any rate, somewhere along the way, Seb and Nut unite, and the product of that union is Isis and Osiris, who are sister and brother. But they have a very... hi, Jan. They have a very unusual relationship in that they're not only sister and brother, but they are also lovers and husband and wife, which is pretty common in mythology. But Isis and Osiris are even a little more unusual in that they are familiar with each other in the womb. Now, supposedly, Helios wasn't kind to the union, and Nut was supposed to deliver her children, and there was a proclamation from Helios Ra to the fact that she could not deliver her children in any month or any week, which produces a rather difficult predicament. They had a 360-day year at this time. And so what happened is they got the trickster, they got Thoth, and Thoth bargained with the moon and took a little bit out of each phase of the moon, each of the 28 days of the moon, and put all of those little bits together, and out of a whole year's worth of little bits, made 5 days, five and almost a quarter days. And in those days, the gods and goddesses were born. And in the further, I got the names written down here. We'll get to them eventually. We don't want to get too technical right away. On the first of those days, Osiris was born. On the second of those days, maybe not the first occurrence of the second of those days, Horus was born. On the third day, Set, who we know as Typhon, he's the bad guy. We got to introduce the bad guy. He's the bad guy in the story. If you think of all of the things of negative Mars in Scorpio, that describes what Seth is like, or Set. On the fourth day, Isis was born, but she was born pregnant with Horus, so there are a few difficulties in the story. And on the fifth day, Nephthys was born. Now, this is Isis, and this is Nephthys, this is Osiris. There are several places here. This is Horus, this is Thoth, this is Anubis, who will come up in the story later on. But they didn't honor the bad guy there's no picture of Set anywhere in this wall painting. He's normally seen as a human with a jackal head. But anyway, Osiris was busy right from the beginning. He was king as well as God. In fact, Osiris came to be known as the only one out of all of the large panoply of gods in Egypt. He's the only one that was known by the name God. And he was the most universal and the most powerful of all the gods. This happens to be a picture of the weighing of the heart or the weighing of the soul against the feather. In this case, this is Asar Mat, Mat meaning justice. He's the embodiment of justice. This is all takes place in the Hall of Justice. And here's a little jar with the soul in, and here's a feather. And if your soul is as heavy as a feather, you don't make it into the resurrection. It's out of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which I'd like to go into, but we probably won't. Now, mind you, this is just the mystery myth. This is not the full story. But Osiris is very busy from the beginning. And he teaches the laws and he teaches religion. He teaches people to honor the gods and to live by higher principles. And he did so by using song and dance and persuasion, rhetoric, things like that. And people really became enlightened under him. And he did this the whole world over. In fact, there is evidence in every mythology, including the Hindu mythology, that there was an influence of Osiris. And while he did this, Isis kept a tight rein on the house and on the country, and everything went fine. However, when he got home, Typhon was on the prowl. And what Typhon did is he got 72 men and collaborated with Aesol, the queen of Ethiopia. And they schemed and conjectured, and somehow they got exact measurements of Osiris. Very exact measurements. And now, know it or not, everything in all of these Egyptian paintings and statuary and everything is geometrically precise. And it's geometrically significant. The different people's bodies are broken up into golden sections, or the measurements of isosceles, right triangles, and things like that. So within their art, there is geometry embedded. They were masters at geometry. In fact, even to be able to build the Great Pyramid took quite a great knowledge of... But at any rate, Set has this wonderful casket made. And it's a wooden casket. They don't say exactly what kind it is, but it exactly measures up to Osiris. And then they have a grand, when Osiris comes back, they have this grand festival, and everybody is fascinated by the box. And Seth announces that whoever fits into it perfectly can have it. And one by one, everybody tries and nobody fits. And the last one is obviously the guest of honor, the host. Osiris gets in and he fits perfectly. Meanwhile, the 72 come running up. They latch the casket shut, and tie it shut, and then they cover it all over with lead. And then they take it to the river and they throw it in the... River Nile. And it goes out to sea, and it goes out to sea in the widest mouth of the Nile, and it's the mouth that ever since the Egyptians have hated. Now, all of this supposedly took place on the 17th day of the month Athor. And that is during a full moon and most likely an eclipse of the moon when the sun is in Scorpio. And Osiris was either 28 years old or 28 years in his reign. And what happens is the first to know about it are all of the little nature spirits, the Pans, and the satyrs, and the Pans and the Satyrs start whispering about Osiris being dead. And this frightened the people so much because they loved their king and God, that this is the origin of the first panics from the Pans and Satyrs. Isis feels very bad, as one would expect, and she takes and cuts one of her tresses of hair off, and starts wearing a mourning dress and mourns deeply. And all of this takes place in the city of Koptos or Koptos. You know, you've heard the term Coptic Christianity. Koptos was one of the seats where Christianity took hold in ancient Egypt. She starts wandering around and she starts asking people if they have seen the casket. And most of all, she listens to little children. And from the little children, she hears that the casket has gone out to sea, and even at which mouth it is located. And somehow it comes to light now that Osiris had an affair with his sister Nephthys. And there was a child from that, because he gave her a necklace made out of honey clover, which I don't know whether that means our regular red clover or whether that means the tall sweet clover plant. At any rate, he gave her a necklace of that, and she bears a child which she exposed out to be killed, and that child was born dog-headed, and that happens to be Anubis. Isis saves the child, and the child turns out to be very wise, sort of like Thoth, and the Anubis advises her what to do. Now, it turns out that the casket went to an area where there are ocean marshes, or where there are on the Mediterranean, where there are marshes where the river comes in. And this was a city called Byblos, not the same Byblos as the one in Phoenicia, from which our word Bible comes, but it could very well have, because Byblos is where they made the papyrus grew, the reeds that they made paper out of. So it turns out that the casket got stuck in a heather bush, and the heather bush grew immensely. Some people feel that the heather bush is an Arabian tamarisk. I didn't check it out. I didn't have time to check that part out to see whether they're in the same family or not. But anyway, this huge tree grows around the casket. And the local king is really astounded by this huge tree, because it's such a big tamarisk tree. And so he cuts off the limbs and he uses the tree as a pillar in his temple in which he lives, which is a fairly common story. If you remember the story of Odysseus having the tree as part of his bed, and the Yggdrasil tree, and if you're familiar with Sigmund and Sieglinde and all of that mythology, the same story is there. This is not, there are a lot of common elements. And from her mourning, Isis begins to hear inside of herself what was called a daemon voice, which we call like talking to ourselves. And the daemon voice and Anubis and the knowledge of the little children all advise her, and she starts hanging out with the queen's maids, and she braids their hair and does things like that. And what happens is a perfume exudes from her, and it passes from her into the bodies of the maids of the queen, and they're not only looking beautiful with their hair, but they smell great. And she wins their confidence, and she eventually wins the confidence of the queen. The queen befriends her and asks her to nurse her child, which she does. But she does it in a strange way. She nurses the child with her finger. And every night when the queen is gone, she takes the child and she puts it in the fire. And she's burning out all of the mortality of it. And all the while the child is in the fire, Isis changes herself into a swallow. And she sort of twitters around as the child is having all of the mortality burned out. The mother gets curious, though. The queen gets curious, and she comes to look and see what's going on. And she is so frightened that she shouts out, and she spoils the whole process of immortality. And Isis reveals who she is. She claims the tree, and she cuts the tree apart and claims the casket inside. And she takes the wood of the tree, and she soaks it down with the juice of fragrant herbs and wraps it in fine linen and gives it to the king and the queen as a present. And they, to this day, or at least to the date that the story was written down, the people still venerate that wood and keep it as a very holy item. She opens the casket and begins to mourn, only she mourns so balefully that her mourning kills all of the children of the king but the oldest. It's really a weird story. It's a very weird story. And she takes the oldest with her, and she dries up a little sidelong river that comes running in there. And she takes the chest with her, and she opens it up when she's in solitude, and she lays on the dead Osiris. And the little child is watching her, and she looks on the little child, and she kills the child with a look. Now something strange happens again. She decides that it's time to go and visit her child. So she leaves the casket lay out in the boonies and goes to visit Horus. Now, in the meantime, Typhon is out again, and he's running around the countryside. And as he's running around the countryside under the full moon, he finds the casket, and he recognizes it. And he decides to do a good job of it this time, and he rips the body into 14 pieces. And he throws each of the 14 pieces into the River Nile and goes on his merry way. Isis comes back, finds the empty casket, and realizes that her husband is not only now dead, but is now dismembered. And she makes a skiff out of paper, papyrus, and she goes up and down the river looking for pieces. And every time she finds a piece, she takes a piece of it and gives it to the people of the city where she happens to be, and they bury that piece there, and they built a temple to Osiris in honor of that piece of his body. Some claim that she didn't really bury the pieces of the body, but there's a version of the story that claims she sewed them back together and that he was resurrected, and that she only gave images, wooden images of the pieces that she found. One piece there is certainly only a wooden image of, and that is the phallus. Because as the story goes, as soon as as soon as the phallus was thrown into the river, there were several species of fish that immediately ate it up. And these fish have been hated ever since then by the Egyptians. And the Egyptians, they seem to like to hate things a lot. And they've never eaten any of these fish ever since. And so Isis, who is apparently very familiar with the dimensions, makes a copy of the phallus, only she makes it rather large, and it is still used in the celebrations of Isis, Osiris, and Horus. After all of this is taking place, Osiris appears as a ghost to his son Horus, and he asks him a number of questions, two of them being the most important. The first question is, what is the best thing that a child can do? To which Horus answered, the best and most honorable thing that a child can do is to revenge its parents. And Osiris is very pleased by this. And then he asks, in this task of avenging your parents, what is the best animal to use? And he expects his son to answer the lion, only his son says the horse. Because if you have a horse, no matter what happens, you can always chase your enemy down and scatter them and destroy them using the horse. Which leaves Osiris very pleased that his son not only has the right spirit, but he's got smarts about him. Then Horus sets out to avenge his father, and to avenge his father by killing Typhon. And as he does so, many people, he's a handsome, bright, shining young man. He's the Apollo of the Egyptians. And many people are won over to him by his character and by the honor of his by the honor of his cause. And even one of the people is the concubine of Seth. And she comes over to him, but he sends a serpent after her, but Horus just takes his sword and cuts the serpent into pieces. And the battle between Seth and Horus lasts many days, but Horus wins, and he binds up Typhon, and he presents him to his mother, who should feel glad that she has a son that has avenged his father. However, Seth happens to be her brother, and she has great pity, and she releases Typhon, and Horus gets angry, and he cuts the crown right off of her head. And ever since then, she wears a headdress that has, I don't know if she's pictured in this one. No, it's not in this one. She wears a headdress of cow's horns ever after, with the moon and sometimes even the sun in between the cow's horns. Then Typhon, when he is let loose, proceeds with legal action, claiming that Horus is not the legitimate heir of his father. And in the ensuing legal battle, Horus is legitimized, and he fights two more fights with Typhon. Their time on them is not given. And he wins both battles. And the final little vignette of the story is that Isis gives birth to a child. And some think that this child was a result of her union with the resurrected, the momentarily resurrected Osiris. And this child is born prematurely and is born lame from the waist down. And that's the story. That's the end of the story. There's much more to the myth of Isis, Osiris, and Horus, but this is the story or the myth as it is used by the mysteries. This myth has been a powerful influencing factor of many, many noble people for many centuries in every part of the world. Probably there are several hundreds of people in the city of Madison that have lived out parts of this myth, and in living out parts of this myth, their life has been changed. Even the Freemasons use parts of this myth in their initiations. And not many of them know what it's all about, and I don't know what it's all about. So now we're going to talk about the myth all over again, but we have to have an introduction or two in between here to talk about what we're going to talk about, and then we're going to talk about it. It's one of those kinds of things. It's pretty clear that, you know, how does it go? It is a mark of divine grace that we aren't in worse trouble than we are for our stupidity. It's pretty much a matter that we are in the dark. And we are in ignorance about what's really going on in the world. And it is not a benign ignorance that we have, but a terribly sinful, if you like to use that word, willful, destructive kind of ignorance that we have. However, the ignorance that we live in is not necessary, and we are not forced to live in it. Now, there are people who claim to have knowledge, with a capital K. Or sometimes this knowledge is called gnosis. They have knowledge of what is behind the illusory garb of reality that we normally look at. And this knowledge is put into the form of mysteries. Like, what is a human being and what is a world? Or how did we and the world come to be as they are? Now, these answers are very much different than the answers that are given to us by material science, which does not have knowledge with a capital K. Material science is very much in the dark and loves its darkness. Or, where? Not only what are we and how did we come to be where we are, but where are we going? Where is humanity going? Where is the cosmos going? And who is all involved in all of this? And when are things going to occur, you know, for major changes in this whole process? And the other thing that the mysteries teach is why. There are large numbers of explanatory whys about the mysteries of things. How did we come to be here? What happens after we die? Why do we die? Why do we go through the process like this? We've been going through, over various years, I've been talking about the mysteries, a lot of what the mysteries are. Now, the people who have this knowledge are, they associate with each other. They're friendly, you know. Pool players associate with each other. Musicians associate with each other. And seers associate with each other. And their associations have always been called mystery schools. Now, mind you, this is not like the PTA. This is an association where your association is founded on living a certain kind of spiritual life in full knowledge of what the cosmos is all about. These mystery schools are associations of people who have worked hard enough and have freed themselves from ignorance, go very far back into time. So far back that they go way back into Atlantis, which was a period of evolution on the Earth that preceded our current condition, way back when most of the water was in a fog state and the oceans hadn't even fully condensed yet. And we breathed in that fog state by using gill sacs, which have since become our Eustachian tubes. And we were much different then. The claims of the mystery schools are that when you can see behind and come to knowledge that what we live in is not a fortuitous happening that has no direction, but that it is an evolutionary creation. It is a grand creation, just like painting a picture like that is a creation. But it's evolutionary in that there are steps and stages and organizations and rhythms within that creation. And that this whole creation, evolutionary creation, is very balanced, and it has all sorts of symmetries and internal rhythms and harmonies. The claim of the mystery schools also is that we are products of that evolution. Everything that we are and what we are not is a consequence of what we have experienced in this creative activity. And not only are we products of it, but we are miniatures of it. That what takes place in the grand cosmos analogously takes place in the microcosm of each individual. So that if we know ourselves, we know the entire cosmos. Obviously, we're just whipping through something really fast here because I want to stay under 90 minutes if I can do it. The mystery schools will teach anyone to learn to experience knowledge in such a way that they can test it or prove it for themselves. If you and I were a student of a mystery school, and we were taught such and such about the nature of reality, we would be taught how we can test that out to see that that's true and prove it to ourselves. And all of the methods of the mystery schools are themselves based on the evolutionary creation. And each experience or lesson in the mystery school is a very concentrated experience of the evolutionary creation brought to full awareness of the patient. Because for the most part, we're sick. This is a healing as well as a process of education. anyone who wants to can avail themselves of the mysteries. It doesn't cost anything, and there's no discrimination. The only thing that it costs is effort, and the only qualification is merit. That if a person has the soul power, has the self-control, has lived a life that is harmonious with the intent of creation, a higher, loving, noble kind of life, that person can petition to be accepted into a mystery school. But very, very few are ready. Very few are capable. When one is brought to knowledge in the mystery school, it is called initiation. And this is not an initiation that is a ceremony or anything like that. The word initiation means start or beginning or commencement. And literally what is meant by the word initiation is the beginning of a waking, fully waking, self-conscious participation in the evolutionary creation. In short, one who is an initiate is aware of their divine being. They know that they are God. An initiate knows that beside having this personality, there is a divine part which is in union with the divine with a capital D. And that this divine part participates in the creative activity at a very high level. And initiation means then awareness of what's going on within the world that we live. So this coming to knowledge is like a birth. And it is, as so many mystery myths have shown, they are myths of somebody waking up to what they are and what they have done wrong and how stupid they have been. You know what I mean? When you say, oh my God, how could I have lived that way? Okay, that is what initiation is. It is the beginning through experience of life in full awareness of the evolutionary creation of which we are part. This is no small experience. Ever after, throughout all of your future lives and all of the future stages of evolution, when you have reached this state, when you have been initiated, you are always conscious. You are always awake. This is no measly state. I have never met in my life an initiate or a person that I thought was an initiate in this sense of the word. This is all of the people in the ancient worlds, even those who went through the lesser of the lesser mysteries, were remarkable and very changed people. Okay. Now we're just about ready to go back and look at the story all over again. I am not an initiate. I am an aspirant to that state. And it's usually my daily humor as well as my daily chagrin to look at myself and laugh at how pitiable my efforts are in relation to the reality of what I'm trying to live up to. It's a godlike individual. The process of initiation is threefold. There are three stages to the initiatory process. The first is breakdown and assimilation. And in the moment of initiation, the initiate is taught, and sometimes spontaneously comes to it on his or her own, to remember and re-experience as much of the cosmic and personal past as the individual is capable of bearing. This is a re-experience with no shielding, in no way watered down. This is like, you know, like when people join, are initiated into Greek fraternities, they go through paddling and things like that. They make them stay up all night and things like that. That those are emblems that represent what's really taking place. You face yourself. You are taught, or you teach yourself, how to remember your past in such a way that as much of this life and of previous periods in the cosmos that you have lived through, you live through that in a full consciousness, knowing that you participated in that, that you made decisions, even the decision to not be receptive in cases where you could not initiate activity. And when you experience something like that with full feeling and full consciousness, it sinks in. And that is the first. You are cleansed thusly, then you don't see yourself as 100 different people. You see yourself as you are. That is, you come to know yourself as a divine being. And that lasts either a short or a long time. The length of time doesn't make any difference. What does make a difference is that you know your godhood, and that you are now in that godhood filled with the essence of all of your previous experience. The third stage of initiation is the beginnings of an understanding of the forces that work in you, how they work into the cosmos, and what the metamorphosis of the cosmos and of yourself is to be. That is, we belong to something that's becoming. And it's a very complex thing. I don't want to talk too much about it. But there are all sorts of symmetries in the creative work in which we are part, and the future is hinted at from that past that we have recently re-experienced. And then one is filled with the desire to fulfill the next stages or transitions in the development of self and cosmos. So those are the three stages of an initiation. There are initiations that get deeper and deeper and deeper. They all follow a similar pattern, but the depth of self-knowing, the depth of experiencing the past, and the depth of creative work into the future becomes grander and grander as time goes on. The claim is that usually in 3 or 4 incarnations, if one works assiduously, after having received the first initiation, one can be liberated and be completely free from the human estate. I don't want to go into more than that, but at any rate, this is a very profound experience and a very profound state of being. One is automatically a mag. One is automatically a seer. One is automatically a healer, having reached this stage of consciousness. This is just a first initiation. Things proceed from there. Now, initiations used to be only performed at special places, special times, on people who were specially prepared. They were put through all sorts of rigorous trials and such like that, and they were very well tested. Even still, in many cases, the initiation, because you leave your body, at least initiation in the last few thousand years has involved leaving the physical body. In Atlantis, it meant just the opposite. It meant coming into the physical body with full awareness. Nowadays, in the modern initiation, it can be happening at any time, any place, to any person who's ready. It usually occurs at certain times and such like that. But in the past, and even now, the mysteries are not like drab school exercises. They are celebrated. It's like the agape, the celebration of divine love. And so what we're talking about is, like, all of what we know as poetry came from initiation. Different chants and things like that used to be part of initiatory work, and touching different bones of the body, and all of the meters that we know in poetry can be traced back to different mystery schools. All of drama was a result of the mystery schools. In most cases, the mysteries were celebrated as dramas. And they were compound psychodramas and cosmic dramas. A psychodrama is where you enact part of your life in such a way that you can see it objectively where you could not see it so the first time the experience took place. And so you relive your life, and they were dramas in that sense. But they were cosmic dramas, in that great mythical things were lived out in the drama. And when you lived out the mystery myth, that was a means of coming out of your regular mundane consciousness and experiencing yourself as something more than your petty personality as you normally conceive of yourself. These are things that there are people who do a lot psychologically and spiritually with dramas to this day. A lot of people get together and act out cosmic dramas. Rudolf Steiner and the anthroposophical people, they still do mystery dramas. They have their own mystery dramas that they act out. They're a little bit personal as far as I can see, and I'm not really too keen on that. But so we're now ready, just about, to look at our myth all over again. But obviously, since none of us, at least as far as I know, none of us is an initiate, we're going to look at interpretation of this little story and try to understand some of it in experience, But we must fall far short, because, you know, if we could really experience, all of us would be initiated. And I'd really love to have a class like that where everybody walked out the door as an initiate. But unfortunately, it doesn't work out that way. Now, this is something like, I suggest, I don't know if you can get them at the public library, but probably at the stacks you can get a copy of Thrice Greatest Hermes. And I suggest that if you really want to look into it, we're going to be looking at mystery myths now for this meeting and two more meetings. And then we're going to move on to variations of history myths in hero and heroine myths. But I suggest that you think about really getting some of the mystery myths and living them out, reading and rereading them and trying to experience them. This is like interpreting dreams. And some of the things that a dream is a low-grade psychic experience, but some of the same things that work for interpreting that work for interpreting myths. Number one, you have to live in the dream. The dream has to be real, you know what I mean? And you have to live in the myth in order to interpret it and to understand it. All events in the myth, all characters, everything that transpires is within you. I am Seth, I am Horus, I am Isis. All of these are parts of ourselves, and unless we own up to them, we cannot interpret the meaning. There is more than one level of meaning. And it's the screwy little things. You know, something doesn't fit right in a dream. You know what I mean? Those odd, weird details, those are usually the things that open up the interpretation of a dream. And in this case, the interpretation of the mystery myth of Isis, Osiris, and Horus is the same thing. There are odd little things. Unfortunately, we're not going to get anywhere near all of the things I would like to go into. Some of the things that we're going to touch on tonight, we're going to touch on at other times, maybe next year, talking about other myths. Everything begins at the beginning. This myth begins right at the highest level of the divines, Ra, Shu, Seb. In order to be initiated, you have to be able to get behind it all. You know what I'm trying to say? It's like reading a good mystery novel or a good spy novel. You have to be able to have access to get behind all of these things. This is why many of the mystery myths begin ab initio, from the very, very beginning of things. You have to be, this is sort of like a story, a modern story of initiation is the story of Descartes going 3 days inside of an oven and becoming a completely changed individual. And the first thing he does is discards everything but the most fundamental fact, his own existence. That is like an initiation. You have to throw out all of your beliefs. You have to throw out throw out all of your assumptions about what you are and get back to the very root, even if this is a something that is infinitely regressive. You have to get to the simplest cycle of regression and identify yourself through that, which is why everything begins with the deepest of the divine hierarchies. And this literally means that in your fundamental nature of being, you are God. And you have to go right back to that very, very fundamental creation, the very basic state of existence. And from there, one realizes a vertical, a proportional vertical state of existence that one normally does not understand. We're so used to living on the horizontal, which is like a color wheel. You can say that red and green are of equal value to each other. They're on the same plane. And so much of our life, you know, if you're in a rowboat or if you're in a boat and a boat is sinking, it might just as if the radio weighs 80 pounds and grandma weighs 80 pounds, throwing the radio over, throwing grandma over, it's the same thing in the material, you know, if you're taking just merely pounds of stuff. But when you have the vertical experience, you have the experience of hierarchy. Some things are more important than other things. And if we're living out a mystery myth in ourselves, which we can do in miniature, even in our daily prayers, we can live that out. We can come to the experience of self as divinity. And within that, we should be able to understand a hierarchy of consciousness within us, a pyramid of values. What is more important than what? Next year, I hope to look at different groupings of divinities and how they were associated differently with different societies and how those societies developed as a consequence of it, trying to get to the issue of understanding the panoply of character within ourselves. Okay, so this is what's happening. You know, we're telling the story that the gods are interacting. This is literally what's going on. Now, it says that this was a secret tryst between Seb and Nut. Seb, by the way, is the Saturn, the Kronos. He's an earth divinity. Ra was associated with fire. Shu was associated with dryness in air. And Osiris was associated with water. And Seb was associated with earth. So, and Nut was associated with heaven. In fact, is often pictured as a divinity with a body that's arched over like that and made up of stars. And even the proportions of the way the body is arched over Seb is all mathematically important. And there's just so many things. I could just have a good time and I could talk, could go on and all little sidelong vignettes and anecdotes and things like that. But okay. Now, when it says that the union of Seb and Nut was in secret, and that Isis and Osiris united inside the womb, that is not saying that this was something that was done on the sneak. This is talking about the deepest level of creation. I don't know how you have your creative acts, like how you write a poem or develop a philosophical insight, but quite a bit of it happens in secret. What I'm trying to say is that there are things that are in such a deep state of unity that if they are separated out, they cannot develop correctly. And if you'll note in your spiritual consciousness that the highest states of creative existence are those when everything is all together, the kind of consciousness relative to our consciousness that we think of right now is like we are asleep, or it's like we're in the womb. And this is talking about, the Hindus would love this myth very much, because in the Vedantin metaphysics, they talk about transcendences of transcendences of, you know, like not only Purushara and Prakriti, meaning spirit and matter, but Maulo Prakriti and a para spirit state, which I forget the name for. But I'm saying that there are states of consciousness in yourself in which you can effect creative actions that can only take place when everything is integral. All right. It's a very profound thing, and I'd like to go off into it, but we just don't have time. And so what we're doing is we're telling the story all over again, but we're looking at things, hopefully, that should be fruitful in our own meditations, in our own creative work. You know, like sometimes, even if you're doing just a simple study of things, sometimes you incubate things in secret inside of yourself, and things you unite together, and then they come, and then they're born later on. And the same thing is like the nature of Isis being born pregnant and giving birth after she herself has just been born. We're talking about there are causes. It isn't just like one domino knocking over another domino, causes and consequences. There are, it's like opening up a box with a box inside of it. There are things where the creation is engendered inside of another creation, and that's the only way it can exist. It's sort of like a marsupial kind of creation that within certain things is the only way that you can generate other things, and when one is born, the other is born out of it. Because this is, you know, because we have a lot of illusions. We have a lot of illusions in the material world, because we see one pool ball or one car bumps into another car, and we think that this is cause and consequence, when we don't realize that things are within another thing. This is one of the things that makes birth such a wonderful experience, because inside of a birth is another birth, because the mother is born at the same time the child is born, because the mother is born to an experience in herself that she could never know any other way. But inside of the child that is being born, there's yet another birth of consciousness that isn't only just the birth of a body. You know what I'm trying to say? That there are things within each other, and that's the mystery that I think is being pointed to in the experience of the Isis, Osiris, and Horus myth. Okay. Now we have to deal here with epigominal days. If you have 24 hours in a day, and you take 1/70th part of it, and there are 28 days to each moon, and there are 13 lunar cycles per year, it turns out to be 5.2 something or another days. I don't know how to say it. I have so many things I want to say. You'd never believe the amount of information that I have written down here. It's thick notes, and I could go on and on and on. You see, the 360-day year was all tied up with the 360-degree zodiac. And different colorations here are indicative that there is a closed system, that different months and different weeks and different periods of time had a rulership, and there was a passing of rulership from one quality or one divinity to another. Now, this is a closed system, and it's a system that has all of these qualities to it. What we're looking at here is something that transcends the qualities in the same way that light transcends a rainbow. Therefore, in order for divinity to be born of the highest order, it had to be born outside of this system. And so this is why they have these epigominal or intercalary days. This is why there are holidays. In our modern consciousness of time, they're still days, and you can say they still belong to months. But what the Egyptians were trying to do with these special days is they were trying to say that there are qualities that transcend, that are above and beyond the closed qualitative system that we live in. And that if you separate out according to the times and seasons, the three stages of producing the epigominal days were called deduction, conduction, induction. In that the deduction meant that you drew out little bits of a quality out of each of the days of the 28-day phase of the moon, and you then conduced them together, and then you induced them into the rest of time. All right, this formula for the production, this is a standard spiritual formula, deduction, conduction, induction, in terms of experiencing things in meditation. This is a little formula. Just like this is a little formula that... Well, I'm just going to have to touch little bitty things here and there, because otherwise we stand no chance of getting all the way through the story. So at any rate, things shifted then from a 360-day year to a 365-day year, the meaning of which, I don't want to go into that. Now, there are little details that come in here that I can read you. I don't want to read the whole. I don't want to read the whole myth. How do you like that? I lost my bookmark. Yeah. And they say that on the first Osiris was born, and that a great voice fell out together with him on his being brought forth, to wit, the Lord of all forth comes to light. This is a curious little part of the story, meaning to say that when Osiris was born, a word fell out all at the same time. This is an awkward way of saying it, but that word was the intelligence. You know what I'm trying to say? We're talking here about a word-born type of consciousness, which we talked about in Hindu creation myths and things like that. It was our firstborn. All right, and then Horus was born on the second day, the elder Horus. And the elder Horus represents sort of the self of selves. It's the sun that we all look at, and the sun represents light altogether, the visible light. Osiris represents more like an invisible word. Horus represents the visible light that is common to all that see, or is common to all eyes, meaning to say. Then on the third Set was born, and funny thing about Set, he didn't come right out of the womb. He punched himself out the side. He was kind of nasty right from the beginning. And this is a very unusual way of stating something. This is geometric, supposedly, that if you have 1, 1, and the square root of 2, this is the side of the triangle that is irrational. Set represents the irrational side of evolution. It represents the intelligence that is in matter that hasn't come to light yet, that hasn't come to creativity yet. And so the punching out of this, you know, I'm trying to go into all the little details. They sound like horrible things when you read them, but when you think about them and ponder them, and this, you know, I've been given the help of several thousand years of mystery students who have given hints every now and then. This is really just amazingly beautiful, all of the things that are there. Then Isis is born pregnant. We've gone a little bit into that. And then a curious thing, Nephthys, who is the Venus of, she's sort of like the Venus of the Heliopolitan gods of Egypt. But then a curious thing happens. Mind you, now, this is written by a man who was an initiate. After all of the gods are born, then it says this. And they say that Osiris and Horus were from Helios, Isis from Hermes, and Typhon and Nephthys from Kronos. Now we have two different sets of parentage. This is a common theme in mythography, that someone may have a number of different sets of parentage. This is not put down to confuse you, because this is a very intelligent man. This is a man that's capable of creating language. Like most of our language, if we look at the dictionary, something like, oh, I forget how many thousands of entries. Most of our language was created by Shakespeare. I hope you realize that. The usage of most of our language was in the hands of a very few people, and a very few people who could take the stuff of language and make words and contexts and things like that. And in our case, it was done by Shakespeare, did magnificent things with our language. But this is somebody who was similarly gifted, or similarly, I don't like to use the word gifted, but it is a gift, but at the same time, it's something he worked on, that was doing the same thing with his language. And this means to say that it's not, he's trying to get away from the idea that this and this puts together equals this. You know, I'm trying to say that our parentage, or what goes into us, is many different things. The idea of thinking one set of causes to one set of effects is wrong. From a spiritual point of view, there are many causes that lead to an event and many consequences that come out of that event. And what this is, the second parentage is something of that nature. Okay. The first thing that Osiris does is gives freedom. We're talking about, at this level, we're living through a myth now. Actually, this is quite an intellectual rendition of it. This is why you'd have to read this over many, many times again and again and relive it. The first thing that Osiris does is he gives people freedom from bondage by teaching them. And this is sort of like a transcendental level of creation. Things are being done more in the spiritual worlds, and everything is happiness and joy. There is differentiation of humans from beasts, and people understand the laws of things, and people are brought to a sense of harmony. This is the early state. This is the state of experience of a human being at the beginning of it all. Okay. And while he's off doing this, it says Isis keeps a tight rein over things. Isis, obviously, in this context, is the divine feminine as associated with matter in the name of nature. Isis has always been seen as a nature divinity, and she ruled with an unconscious intelligence by being associated with the brute matter which was coming into being. And this is what it means, that there are some things, because when we're talking about initiation, you know, most of the work that we do every day we're not aware of. But really, something in us is beating the heart, and something in us is doing the breathing, and something in us is stimulating the nerves and muscles. And that unconscious part of ourself is the part of self that is represented by Isis. In our beginning to wake in consciousness, everything is sweetness and joy, and the physical functions are taking over and doing on their own. That's sort of like, if we're looking at this as an evolution of consciousness, which we must, if it's a mystery myth, it's something like that. Okay, and now we have to come to the 72, we're talking about now Osiris comes back home, and Typhon, Set, has gotten together these 72 people, which is 72 equals 1/5 times 360, which means that the 72 is, is the grand pentacle. We are talking about the process of the divine being made human. We're talking about the involution of spirit into matter, of the divine consciousness being brought into an individual microcosm, one human being. We are the five-pointed star, and the 72 that goes with it, that are aligned with Set, that is Set, again, we've got to remember, represents the irrational that is working in us. It's irrational because we haven't brought it to light yet. It hasn't been bound up. It hasn't been tamed. And so this is... taking the 72, they're wanting to take the divine and bring it down to the human estate. And the human estate, not rather than an animal estate or something like that, because a human being has the capability with the self-conscious spiritual focus of being a microcosm. That is, when one says, I am, one is saying the same thing that the macrocosm says, I am. So that we are a complete and total, the human state is a complete and total state, but material. Ethiopia was the land of darkness. Aso, as the queen of Ethiopia, you know, the ancient name for Egypt was, I could go into wild and all kinds of things at this point, but I'll just start hinting at a few things. The ancient name for Egypt was Chem, which is where our word chemistry comes from. The word chemistry means the science of Egypt. And chemistry, what we call alchemy, meaning the science of chemistry, there is in alchemy a substance that is within the individual microcosm that is known as the Dark Queen. It is called Azoth. It was the driving spinal fire that brought about the light inside of the Philosopher's Stone after you had developed the Philosopher's Stone inside of the hermetically sealed cask, and you went through all the processes, like the deduction was the process of precipitation. And such like that. We're talking about all kinds of alchemical formulae here, but we're also talking about a union of the intelligence with the queen within the Aso force. But I don't want to go into all of that too much. I just want to hint and say that these are things that you can look at if you actually want to. Now, the measure of Osiris. Typhon took the measure of Osiris. When taking the measure, it's more like yogurt takes. Meaning to say that the brute forces of nature took the measure of intelligence of the divine force that was manifesting in nature. And the process of building the casket, I don't understand this one completely. This is something that I have now for at least 18 years. No, actually more than that, in the 20s of years, I have tried to figure out, because so many myths have the little casket in, everything from the myth of Moses the one that we're going to look at in a few meetings from now, the myth of Perseus, they have this casket that gets put out to sea. The casket is taking and putting the measure of the casket is taking, it's a process of squaring the circle. Meaning to say, taking the divine intelligence, which is part of the light, and building it into matter. Because squaring the circle is where you make a square that's equal in volume to a circle, meaning to say that the spirit becomes materialized. And the process, in order to get around the, you know, normally a squaring process involves an inscription and a superscription. And the difference between the two squares, the Pythagoreans and other mystery schools put the difference between these two squares, they put them in rectangles. And, it's too many. That's a picture of one of the caskets of the rectangle in relation to the square that has to do with the squaring of the circle. It's a mystery. I don't want to, you know, we could talk about spiritual mathematics. We've done it in the astrology class. I don't want to get into that too far. But the thing of it is, when the intelligence of the known is projected into the unknown ignorance of matter, what occurs is that, looking back at it, the interface between intelligence and ignorance produces a fascination. This is why everybody who looked at the casket was fascinated by it. You know, the same thing where we get fascinated by chemistry or meteorology or things like that, knowing that there's an intelligence inside of it. This is curiosity. in the highest sense. Because curiosity in the highest sense, we project our spiritual light into darkness. And not only is our spiritual light reflected at us, but it's transforming the unknown. And this is why everybody wanted that casket. Because it represented a state of fascination, of curiosity, of the unknown that is becoming. The unknown is sort of like the infinite feminine that's constantly leading us on, constantly giving birth to new intelligence. All right, so Osiris steps into the casket, and it gets slapped shut and gets covered with lead, which has to do with has a whole bunch to do with chemistry of blotting out the etheric body and all such like that. It produces an ignorance. You want to kill somebody, just put them in a lead room. You know, you can still breathe and such like that in there, but eventually you vitiate the etheric body so much that the person dies. That just used to be things like when emperors tried to kill each other, or future emperors, they would have people build them houses, but they would have the walls and ceiling and everything like that be sheet lead. And I don't want to get into it. It's the graveyard metal and all of those things. I don't want to, we could go on and on and on. But now we are at a major changing point. Everything has been sweetness and light until this point. And now body is put into the casket, and the casket is thrown into the river. The river, you can call it a redness, or you can call it the river Ganges. In this case, you can call it the river Nile. In the mysteries, it's always been called the river Ocean. Oceanus. This is a very curious river, because if you go downstream, you become human, and if you go upstream, you become divine. Very curious river. That river is none other than the caduceus of Mercury, going one direction, because Osiris is now going into matter. This is exactly very much the story of Christ. There are some significant differences. I don't know whether we're going to study the Christ mystery myths or not. I haven't decided on that yet. But this is the acceptance of the experience of death. This myth is saying that the God had to come into the body, had to enter into ignorance. And this is, remember now, the initiation is we're living through our past evolution and where we're going to. So when he was thrown in the river and went downstream, he became human. And the definition of human is death. Okay. Oh, boy. I don't want to. We could talk about the sea representing chaos. This occurs at a full moon, which is probably an eclipse. The reason they claim that it's an eclipse is because Isis is always pictured as veiled, and the moon. This is a solely lunar myth. We're going to look at the sidereal qualities. Oh, we're not getting a chance to do it. Do you want to break off and continue this another time? Because otherwise what's going to happen is this is going to take way too long. I didn't want to do it at this long of a time, but it's such a lovely myth. You know what I'm saying? All right, so this occurs at the full moon in Scorpio, emblematic of death, emblematic of destruction. All of the life of the year is done, and it's now coming to be winter. You might say that the going into the cask and being covered by lead, the middle of winter, from what we're talking about here, is Capricorn. which relative to the equator is deep, deep down. And that is like the underworld.